This is Ron Real Entrepreneurship, the show that brings the no-nonsense truth of what is required to start, grow, and scale your business. I am your host, Susan Sly. Well, what is up, Ron Real Entrepreneurs, wherever you are in the world? I hope you're having an amazing, amazing day. And to those of you who've left five-star reviews, like, hello, thank you. The reviews are pouring in. And don't forget, if you give a five-star review and you email it to with the link reviews@susansly.com, and I read it on the air, I will give you a $50 Amazon gift card. And you know, that's like gold right there. Anyway, my guest today is the co-founder and CEO of Tango, which takes the pain out of the documenting process by automatically generating how-to guides while you work. He, and along with his co-founders, Brian Schultz and Dan Giovancini, I have to use the Italian pronunciation, dropped out of Harvard Business School during the pandemic to start the company. And I'm sure some parents were not happy about that. Since then, the company has grown to nearly 300,000 users and 35 full-time team members, which is its own aspect of Ron Real Entrepreneurship right there. And Tango has been recognized as a finalist for Product Hunt's Product of the Year, Google's 12 favorite Chrome extensions of 2022, and Fast Company's Next Big Things in Tech for 2022. Tango has raised $19.7 million in venture capital funding today, and we're going to talk about what it's like to raise money in this current climate. And prior to HBS, he spent most of his career in the Bay Area at Uber, where he had roles in launch operations, data science, and product strategy from 2014 to 2018. He holds a bachelor's degree from Cornell University, where I almost went, but to my dad's disappointment, I didn't. Where he met his amazing wife, Colleen. Together, they live in Chicago with their Havanese poodle mix, Balboa, and one-year-old son, Quinn. He is an avid skier like me, Bill Simmons listener like me, chicken wing enthusiast, not so much, but we both do love football. My guest today is the one and only Ken Babcock. Ken, thank you for being on Ron Real Entrepreneurship.
Thanks for having me. That was a mouthful. There's a lot going on there.
Well, you're an impressive person, my friend. Chicken wing enthusiast. I need to know about that. I know it has nothing to do with entrepreneurship in this regard, since neither of us own a chicken wing outlet. But what does that mean to be a chicken wing enthusiast?
I mean, it kind of just comes with growing up in Buffalo. I'm from Buffalo, New York, originally, home of the chicken wing. And, you know, so it's sort of a point of pride to always say that chicken wings that you have outside of Buffalo just aren't as good. And it's always a point of pride to have like your specific place in Buffalo that no one's really heard of. And, you know, it's like outside the city and they do something weird with their chicken wings. And so naturally I have that too.
So what is the restaurant you want to give a shout out for chicken wings? I grew up in the restaurant industry. I just spoke at the restaurant leadership conference on AI, and I always love promoting restaurants. So give a shout out to the best, in your most humble but accurate opinion, chicken wing establishment in Buffalo.
Yeah. Well, it's chicken wings and beef on Weck, which is also a Buffalo delicacy. It's a roast beef on Kimmelwick sandwich, Barbell Tavern in East Aurora. So they've blown up a little bit. They have a couple locations now, but the one in East Aurora, the original one, nothing better in the summer. They open the windows, they got the patio going, you get chicken wings, you get beef on Weck. It's a classic. You got to go.
Okay. So we will put these links in the show notes, friends, just in case you're in Buffalo. And a shout out to my dad who listens to every show, who is the OG Buffalo Bills fan. So Ken, let me ask you, we may talk about football. You never know what we're going to talk about on the show, but I want to jump in with a hot topic right now, fundraising, because this is a very interesting fundraising climate. So what are you hearing from other friends who are, you know, in the grind? And what have you observed right now this year in terms of raising money?
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky in that we raised a little over a year ago. So we still have plenty of runway. But, you know, as a co-founder and the CEO, I mean, you always have tabs on what's going on. You always have to be thinking about, you know, your financial situation. You know, I think I tend to think about my role in three ways. hire and retain the best people, make sure we don't run out of money, and tell the vision internally and externally. And so that piece around making sure, you know, you don't run out of money means you got to be confident that you can fundraise. The stuff that I'm hearing now, I mean, it kind of comes back to the whole economics of venture investing. You know, there's LPs that invest in venture funds that invest in companies. And so all the money kind of flows through that. A lot of those LPs are pension funds, state of California, the state of Illinois. It might also be, you know, high net worth individuals. But, you know, what happens when, you know, the economy is, there's more uncertainty, is they start moving their assets around. And so what I've been hearing is that it's been harder for venture funds to raise money from those LPs. And that has all these downstream impacts on people like us, mm-hmm. where there's no line of sight into a future fund, or if they need to, you know, make investments that give confidence to those existing LPs, there's just a lot more scrutiny going on in the fundraising market. Now, to be clear, I think that's probably a good correction from 2020, 2021. But it does make it hard because you really have to go out and tell the story. And so it's dicey. I mean, you know, you see AI companies raising a ton of money at huge valuations. You know, you're not necessarily sure what that means. And then you have other companies that, you know, are sort of thinking about wind down, how they give their team a soft landing. So it's kind of two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And to your point, the transparency isn't a bad thing. You know, you think about Theranos and you think about, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried, and you think about the nefarious things that have gone on. And yet at the same point, I think that just because, you know, I know just because like we're an AI company, just because someone's an AI company, there's a lot of appeal for, say, Gen AI, but there's newer forms of AI, like so what we do, computer vision at the edge, that doesn't, you know, it doesn't have this same kind of cachet yet. And so it's also the challenge is explaining what it is, especially to VCs who are like, oh, okay, it's AI, but they don't really know about AI, or different types of VCs who haven't invested in AI. I've never seen a climate like this. Honestly, it's fascinating. And then on top of it, the private investors, the angels, they're looking at, are we having a recession? If we are, is it a soft landing? What is the Fed going to do? You know, it's the list goes on and on. And it's this resilience, especially as CEOs. So let me ask you you know, I want to get into the origin story of Tango. So aside from being a hot wing enthusiast, and aside from all of that, you drop out of business school to start this company. And what was that first point you realized that there was a pain that you knew you could solve? Because there's a lot of people out there who have ideas, they observe pain points and they complain about them, but they don't actually execute on starting a company to fix something. So when was that moment?
It really coincided with the pandemic. So, you know, we were in the middle of school our first year, and, you know, March of 2020 kind of shifted the entire experience for us. We were playing around with Tango. It wasn't called Tango at the time, but we kind of had this idea around how do you digitize the shadowing experience, which is like a staple of so many onboarding processes across industries, companies, roles. And we had some early thoughts on what Tango could be, you know, this sort of automatic documentation solution, asynchronous. And so we were doing a lot of customer discovery, you know, and the conversations were generally positive, which is, you know, you always got to take that with a grain of salt when you're first starting a company, because most people don't want to give you critical feedback. And so the conversations would wrap with, oh, I'd love to try it. Like, good on you guys for starting something. Like, yeah, like happy to support. And then with the pandemic, you know, what we saw is with a lot of these customers, they were going remote. Their teams were going distributed. They were having to do layoffs. Like, knowledge was like fleeing their organization. So the just the tenor of those conversations went from, I'm happy to be helpful, to, can you guys build this yesterday? And so, you know, for a lot of entrepreneurs, it is kind of like, oh, do I jump in the deep end? I don't know. I don't have enough signal. For us, it was kind of overwhelming, where we were all in school. That experience had changed for the worse. And we had very real customers at real companies saying, go build that thing that you said you want to build. And that for us was kind of, I think, the point where we're just trying to figure out, okay, how do we drop out of business school? How do we build this thing? And that was the beginning.
Mm. So I love what you said about, firstly, the knowledge was fleeing their organizations. And so there's this, you know, we have many people around the world who listen to the show, who are looking for that signal that it is time to start something. So there's the, you go, oh yeah, okay, this is a problem. And we've already ideated on a potential way to solve it. And so those are the first two steps. And then the next thing is, how do we execute on it? So how did you get the funding to start and create the first beta?
Yeah, so we raised a seed round in the fall of 2020. So, you know, we finalized our deferral from HBS in August. And then we went out in September, basically a slide deck. I mean, we had some interns who were, you know, unpaid at the time, but just wanted to work on an idea. One of those interns is actually still an employee of Tango, which is awesome. She's seen it from the get-go. But we went out with a slide deck mostly and said, here's what we think we can do. Here's some mock-ups. Here's some quotes from customers. Here's some people to talk to. But, you know, we're committed to doing it. And in that environment, that was enough. And, you know, we're lucky to have some great investors come on board at that point. But it did feel like, you're like, wow, I'm really selling here. You know, I've got a deck, I've got an idea, I've got a vision, but you know, who knows if all those things are right. So that's
how much
where we
did
started.
You raise?
So in total, we did a priced round, raised about 2.5 there, and then later did a safe for an additional 3 million. So it wasn't all in that fall 2020. It was sort of over time, but it was like as we were getting more validation of the idea.
Did you have any investors turn you down in that seed round?
Yeah, what's the ratio? Like 30 to 1?
Tell that, because there are a lot of people who are listening and they, you know, they hear these stories, Ken, and they haven't had the experience yet. So there's, in traditional sales, and you know this just as well as anyone, you've got to know your own numbers. And when I look at any of my experience in selling and closing deals, I always start to quantify it. So in the old days, I'd keep Excel spreadsheets. So how many conversations did it take in order for me to, you know, get my first sale, right? And so in the same thing with raising money. So I'm always curious about, like, what would you estimate that percentage was? Like, how many pitches did you do versus how many actually wrote checks? And what was the smallest check size and the biggest check size?
Yep. So the way I think about it, think about a typical seed round process. You have an intro meeting, maybe you have a meeting with another partner. Then you go to a partner meeting, and that's typically three steps. There might be some diligence in between. Hey, can you intro me to some customers, some of your advisors? But those three steps. And so when you look at those three steps, you should expect probably 50% attrition between all of them, where people are going to say, I'm good. Thanks though. And so when you work backwards from that, I mean, we had 4 institutional investors participate. So you need obviously a lead, then you have other people that are going to commit. And so we had 4 institutional. So if you do the math back from that 3-step process, or, you know, so you get to 8 partner meetings, 16 second rounds, and you get to, you know, maybe 32 intro calls, And it's actually probably more than that, honestly. So, you know, if I were to go back, I bet we did 45 to 50 calls to get those four checks, which, you know, they range from probably 350,000 from a participant to, you know, $1 million from the lead. So, and that's another dynamic in and of itself, right? Like people will say, oh yeah, I'm in, I'm not going to lead, I'm not going to set terms. You need to find that lead. And that complicates things too, because then you're walking around, you're like, do I have an asset in my back pocket? Like I have someone who's committed, I have someone who's interested, but they're not willing to step in up and lead. Like what signal does that give to future pitches? And so we tried to do some of that, but it's just such a game.
It is. How long did it take you that first round?
Yep. So, you know, I would say probably we kept it tight. I mean, we were good about that. And that's all sort of, you have to keep it tight yourself, because otherwise firms will want to drag on. So we created an artificial deadline. We basically said, hey, you know, we're going to do this round or we're going to go back to school. And so like, here's the timeline. And if we do the round, we're not going back. I'm like, we'll sign affidavits or whatever you need. But we said, this is our drop dead date. This is when we need to get the round done. And so all in all, that was 4 weeks. So that is one of the big takeaways. And one of the big advice I'd give to founders is like, always create a false sense of urgency, because investors are operating on incomplete data. They always are. At some point you need them to make the leap and make that judgment based on incomplete data. And if you just keep the window open, they're going to want to see you again and again and again. And at a certain point, like that's a huge time suck for you.
Yeah, no, that's great advice, Ken. And the, you know, I love how you went through the numbers, because you're talking 45 to 50 calls in a 4 week time frame. And, you know, that, you know, you have an idea, you know, there's customer demand, but you're very early or zero revenue for this first round. So it's like zero. So you're raising money where they're like, show me your financials, and there are none. So yeah. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of people who had a lot of questions, but they weren't the appropriate questions to ask, especially in the early stage that you were in. During that time, did you or your partners ever, you know, have a wall kicking moment or something? You maybe thought an investor was going to come in and they decided last minute not to come in. Like, what was the most stressful thing that happened in those 4 weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had, so coming back to the last conversation, we had an investor who said, yeah, we'd be willing to lead. And then they said, nah, we're going to participate. Okay, well, at what amount? Because at some point it's this big puzzle of like, how much dilution do you want to take? Like, you don't know what those terms are because the lead hasn't come in yet. And then they go, oh, well, you know, but we still want to do this amount of money. It's like, well, we can't do that. Like the math just doesn't work. We don't want to take 35% dilution on our seed round. And so, you know, it is this challenging thing where you're like, you feel like you're begging. Because it's your seed, like you said, you don't really have a ton of ground to stand on. You have someone who's committed, but they're totally throwing off the economics and they're totally changing it in their favor. And you have to be, you know, it's still your company. Like you still have to be protective. And I mentioned this to you actually, Susan, right before we jumped on this call, but you know, it was always a helpful reminder to me to just reference this quote of like, capital is a commodity, companies are rare. Just remember, like in every round, there's the vanity metric of how much did you raise and who did you raise it from. But you're selling part of your company. You know, you're giving that to someone. You're obviously getting something in exchange, and without it, you don't have a company. But you know, just keep that in mind. Like, don't chase the big numbers, because it has an impact on.
Yeah, I love that. Capital is a commodity. Companies are rare. We were talking about that before we started the show. And that, you know, it's that abundant mindset. And I've had founders that, you know, one of the founders, my friend Pratik, he was like, yeah, we were rejected by 75 investors. And Then I had another founder, Ken, and she came on the show and she was already at revenue with her idea. No one was funding her. And the same VCs that didn't fund her funded a guy who had a slide deck who hadn't even proved out the concept, but it was her exact same concept. And he was bringing in money like crazy. And some of the best advice I've received is, it's not fair. So what? How are you going to play the game? So now I told you I'd bring in football. So I'm going to give you the football reference. This is great advice I received about raising money. Every day when you're in your raise is like the Super Bowl. And so I'm a massive, long, long time New England Patriots fan. And so we can agree not to be friends, but I'll just use this example. So we're in the Super Bowl and you think you are going to have like, everyone's going to be healthy that day. And, you know, you're going to have like back in the OG, like, you know, Gronk's going to be non-concussed and you're going to have Amendola and Brady's going to be in prime shape and you're going to have everyone is going to be there and it's going to be awesome. And then it's game day and someone has a concussion from practice and someone hurt their ankle and can't throw properly. You know, the list goes on and on. And you don't give up. You go, okay, what is the team that we have to put on the field today? And you play that team. And all the critics are just in the stands. They're fans. You can't hear them. The noise is so loud. And you put your freaking head down and you play the game to win. And so that has been the best advice I've received about raising money, because every day I'll just go, okay, who's in the game today? And who, by who's in the game, it's not just the players on my team that are, you know, healthy, fit, the right mindset, but who, whether it's strategic, whether it's VC, who's in play, who are we under due diligence with? What are the conversations we're having? And what is the game we're playing today? And are we going to move that field, the ball down the field to get the touchdown? And then do we make do you have to do a smaller round? Do you go for the field goal because you didn't get the touchdown? So there, I told you I'd bring football in.
I love it. That's great. You know, that actually reminds me of one of the best books I've read on leadership is it's the story of Bill Walsh. And the title of the book is The Score Takes Care of Itself. And I think in the foreword, which is written by his son, he references, you know, Bill Parcells calls Bill Walsh and says, we are literally playing in the Super Bowl, but you know, we have these guys are hurt. I mean, it's a perfect analogy to what you're saying. And Bill Walsh just says, nobody cares. And so sort of a spin on what you're saying, nobody cares. Like you have to play your own game. You have to figure it out. In some ways that's like very liberating, right? Because it's like, well, no one's gonna take inventory of the excuses. So don't make them, just do the thing.
Yeah. And when you put the time limit on it, it's no different than the game. So the game has a start, it has a finish, it has four quarters, unless you're tied. And then you may, you know, go into overtime. But at the end of the day, I think for me, just having been a former athlete, when that analogy was given to me by a mentor, I got so energized. Like I always say, raising money is fun because it's the mindset, right? And it's just like, okay, how are we going to play today? I can only control how I show up. And I know you're the very same type of person. I can control that as a CEO. I can't control how anyone else shows up. I can't control who's in the game that day, who's not. All I can control is me and work with what I've got. I want to ask you, you know, there are 90% of startups fail. The number one reason is cash flow. You already talked about that. You're an excellent steward of your company. But how did you get the first paying customers? Because that's the question. Like when people write in questions, ask them, how did they get the first paying customers? I've got the idea. I've got some funding, but now I'm scrambling to get customers. How did you guys do that?
So I think it all comes down to what your go-to-market motion is. And so for us, I mean, I don't want to say it was easy because we made like a conscious decision around our go-to-market motion. What I mean by that is, you know, our product is bottoms up adopted. So we, you know, from out the gate, I mean, we have a selling motion now, but out the gate, we didn't have a sales team. We didn't have a form on our website. We didn't have, an opportunity for enterprise customers. We just didn't have it. And the reason for that is, if you think back to what we're building, you know, creating documentation in seconds while people are working in the context of their tools and processes, so they don't have to go off and do it on their own. You know, you have to think about who that pain is felt by. So for us, throughout our customer discovery, we always realized that it was these like frontline employees. Those are the people that were like really feeling the pain. And when we talked to like their bosses or their boss's boss, who would in theory be the buyer for a sales-led team, they didn't talk in the same way. They were like, oh yeah, sounds good. You know, it's like, oh, you should brush your teeth twice a day. Oh, yep, absolutely. Or, you know, it's good hygiene, right? That's how they felt about it. Whereas when we talked to these frontline workers, they were like, oh my God, I spend hours creating these meticulous how-to guides that nobody reads and the formatting gets all thrown off. I mean, it was like, we had to cut the calls off. And so for us, being bottoms up meant people could go to our website, they could navigate to our Chrome extension, they could download it on their own. There'd be no touch point with anyone on the Tango team. And so for us, getting those first paying customers was about offering a compelling paid experience. We'd always have a free experience, but let's offer a compelling paid experience. And what we recognized with that was that, you know, people just wanted more customization, more branding of their workflows, of their tutorials. And so we gave that. And so we turned it on probably 2 months after we launched the product and, you know, had 100 or so subscriptions in the first day. And those were the first dollars in the door. So that engine of product-led growth, of low-touch sort of selling, has worked wonders for us.
That's fantastic. And I, you know, you get that end user. And my first thought when you were talking about those customers and that those conversations, you're like a therapist, right? Because, and it happens, especially in the startup world. And I always teach my team, like sometimes we're going to build the airplane while we're flying it. And for the team members that have come from big corporations, it scares them. Like we have employees who've come from Google and Amazon and CVS Health and all these, you know, Chase and all these different places. And they're like, when you first said that, Susan, it scared me. And I said, but they were like, now I get it. And some of that is, to your point, it's that process-driven documentation that's going to be customer-facing. And it's like, you know, translating it from what do we have to understand internally, but what does the customer have to understand? And that doesn't always translate. And so that pain, so you had like both a white collar on and your therapy hat, which was awesome. There's so many things, Ken, I could ask you, but I think, you know, what's on my heart to really ask is I'll preface this by saying you came from Uber. And I, in the hundreds of founders I've interviewed a lot lately who started their companies during the pandemic. And you have a one-year-old sweet son. So during that time, while you're starting the company, you also find out that Colleen is pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. So you're building a company, you've left HBS, you're raising money, you're building a company, and you know, now you're having a family. I have a personal belief that those of us who founded companies during the pandemic or started to get the first customers during the pandemic are going to be the next big unicorns because of the resilience. So what did the pandemic do for you in terms of resilience as a founder?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a lot of, and this is true of everybody. I don't want to make this so unique to me, but the things that I had signed up for, Harvard Business School being the, you know, the primary one, had just changed overnight. And it went from being this incredible in-person experience with all of these relationships that I was building and experiences that I wouldn't have otherwise. And then it was like, nope, you're not going to have those. Those are gone. We'll give you a diluted experience. Oh, by the way, we'll charge you the same amount. And so in a lot of ways, it was kind of like a, ooh, this isn't it. You know, I always envisioned that this was it, but now it's not it anymore. And so how do I go find something that will be it? You know, I mean, just taking a step back and thinking about how you spend your time and how you move through your career. And so, yeah, I definitely think there's a certain level of resilience that was built. I mean, also building a team entirely remotely, we're still remote, still distributed. 40 people in 16 states. And there's pros to it, right? We have great access to talent. We hire people that independent of where they live, which is, has been amazing for us. But like building that culture is hard. Like, how do you form bonds between people when you're not in the same place? You don't have that opportunity to go out for lunch or go for coffee. And so we've had to be very diligent about that. So there's just a lot of things that have been thrown our way, which is true for many founders, where we've had to kind of go the extra mile to figure it out. And so that, you know, that resilience is part of the foundation of Tango for sure.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Really contemplating that the, one of my favorite sayings is leadership is forged in the flame of challenge. And the, we were in offices, but also, you know, had remote employees, and then the pandemic happened and we still maintain an office. Then we added an office during the pandemic. So like, we're still, you know, growing the company, and, you know, even looking back at, there was a shortage of available tech workers. So maybe hiring people that didn't make sense at the time. And then, you know, all of those different things, I think, in my opinion, that's why those of us who are in this time right now, who came through that, we just think differently. And there's a resilience, as I mentioned, and the flexibility, and understanding too that the talent that we want are making different demands because of the pandemic. And so your best people may have come from Google, or they may have come from wherever, but if they do not want to work in an office and you really want them, right? So what are those trade-offs? And it's such an interesting climate. Well, Ken, I want to thank you for being here. And I put on, so just a funny story, friends, I have my daily list of things I will accomplish, but when something becomes really important, I put it on a post-it. I learned that from one of my mentors who was in his 90s. So I actually put Tango on a green post-it. I don't think you can see it with my background. I don't think it's going to happen. Anyway, so I put it as an action item, because even as a startup founder, and to your point, the documentation and what that looks like for various customers based on their needs is something that we're going through right now. So I get it. And, you know, so I kudos to you. I don't say this lightly. I really feel that what you have is definitely in that unicorn stratosphere. So I'm so excited for you. Are you going to go back to business school?
No, but I appreciate the kind words, you know, thank you for that. I mean, yeah, the problem that our customers experience is so pervasive. I don't see a reason why I would go back.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat, but that's a conversation for another day. I decided I was going to do my MBA at MIT, and I decided to defer applying. I've done, you know, another education at MIT, but I just thought, you know, I'm in this hyper growth phase and it's just not the time for me. And, you know, when I feel like dipping my toe back in the MIT water, I just do. But you know, right now there's just too much to do. And it's like being a parent and growing a company and yesterday alone, we had my son's 21st birthday and my daughter's grade 8 graduation. And like the week before, we had a high school graduation. I mean, there's just so much going on. And do I want to be doing homework, or do I want to be actually out there, you know, building this company and making sure I have those moments? So I so appreciate you being on the show, and everyone will put all of Ken's social in the show notes. We'll put, of course, there's the full transcript. We'll put the link to Tango. And if you resonate with anything on the show, please give us a shout out on social. We love tag, give a great review. If you're going to give a rotten review, just don't give one. I hope your mother told you, if you have nothing nice to say, don't say it. But if you're going to give a great review, we'd love to have one. So thank you again, Ken, for being here.
Thanks for having me, Susan. This was fun.
Well, thank you. With that, everyone, this has been another episode of Raw and Real Entrepreneurship. Go out there, God bless, and rock your day. And I will see you in the next episode. Hey, this is Susan, and thanks so much for listening to this episode on Raw and Real Entrepreneurship. If this episode or any episode has been helpful to you, you've gotten at least one solid tip from myself or my guests, I would love it if you would leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. After you leave your review, go ahead and email reviews@susansly.com. Let us know where you left the review. And if I read your review on air, you could get a $50 Amazon gift card. And we would so appreciate it because reviews do help boost the show and get this message all over the world. If you're interested in any of the resources we discussed on the show, go to susansly.com. That's where all the show notes live. And with that, go out there, rock your day. God bless. And I will see you in the next episode. Are you currently an employee looking to start your own business? Maybe you've been thinking about it for a while and you're just not sure where to start. Well, my course, Employee to Entrepreneur, combines my decades of experience as an entrepreneur with proven methods, techniques, and skills to help you take that leap and start your own business. This course is self-paced, learn on demand, and comes with an incredible workbook. And that will allow you to go through this content piece by piece by piece, absorb it, take action, and then go on to the next module. So check out my course on susansly.com, Employee to Entrepreneur.